Brian, thank you so much for agreeing to do this. I think it's fair to say that dyscalculia is something that many schools are now much more aware of, but maybe don't know enough to move their thinking forward. So it'd be great if we could think today about what is dyscalculia. What is the research telling us about what we as teachers need to know and understand, and then what we can learn from the research in terms of what we do in order to support young people who have challenges in their learning. So would you like to start by explaining who you are and what your connection is with it?
My name is Brian Butterworth. I'm Emeritus Professor of Cognitive Neuropsychology at the Institute of Cognitive Neuroscience at University College London. And I've been researching typical and atypical mathematical abilities for 20-odd years now. And I started because we found neurological patients, patients who'd had some kind of brain damage through stroke or some kind of traumatic incident, who seemed to have lost their numerical abilities, but no other abilities. So their intelligence, their speech, their memory was all perfectly okay. It was just that they had this problem with numbers. And it turned out, of course, of our research, that there was one particular area in the brain that seemed to be involved. And that's called the left parietal lobe, sort of above your left ear. And when this is damaged, you very often find these numerical problems. So the question then arose, why this area? And this is really a developmental question. Why did this area come to be specialised for number? And if it becomes specialised for number, is it possible that this specialisation in some people doesn't work very well? To take an analogy, we've all inherited neural mechanisms that allow us to see the world in colour. However, there are some people for whom the world is not in colour or is in atypical colour. And this is just an accident of their birth, that they can't see the world in colour in the normal way. And it may be like that with number. And in fact, it's been argued, and in fact there's quite good evidence now, that we see the world in number rather like we see the world in colour. It's not something that you can switch off. You can't decide to see the world in black and white, and you can't decide that you're not going to see the number of people in the room. Now, you may not be aware of it, you may not remember it, but your behaviour responds to the number of objects that seem to be relevant to your actions at that time. Now, our argument about dyscalculia, that some people are born with, maybe 5% of people are born with, is that something's gone wrong with the mechanism that enables the rest of us to see the world in numerical terms. Now, if you can't do that, it's very difficult to learn arithmetic in the usual way. So when you learn how to, for example, count using counting words, you usually see a group of objects and you go through them one by one. Now that's okay, but if you're not going through them one by one and you just look at them and you can't tell by just looking how many there are, this is going to be a problem. And we've argued that this is the basis for learning arithmetic, and if this isn't an efficient mechanism, then you're going to have trouble learning arithmetic. And this is what distinguishes dyscalculia for just being bad at maths. But in 1974, so about 40-odd years ago, a Slovakian neuropsychologist called Ladislav Koš was the first, really, to show that there's a developmental form of dyscalculia which had previously only been observed in patients with brain damage. So Koš was careful to distinguish between what he called dyscalculia, based on the sort of arguments that I've given, from what he calls pseudo-dyscalculia, which is being bad at numbers for other reasons. So the science now tells us that the brains of learners, children and adults with dyscalculia, are different from the rest of us, and in particular they're different in the left parietal lobe, at least for most learners. I mean, there are some anomalous learners for whom the right hemisphere is specialised for numbers. Mm. But it's basically a network that's centred on the left parietal lobe with links to the left frontal lobe.
So let me just ask you again about seeing the world numerically. Does that have implication for the whole concept of learning patterns and seeing patterns? So I'm just thinking about teachers in the early numeracy stages. What are the implications of what we know from what you've just described about that kind of spectrum between the dyscalculia based on damage and the pseudo-dyscalculia, so that there is spectrum scope almost for moving along and making progress in relation to seeing numerically? What do we know about that?
Well, two questions you ask is this a pattern perception problem? It doesn't seem to be. There's some suggestion that if you've got poor visual memory, you're going to be bad at arithmetic. But that's not quite the same as being dyscalculic. It sort of just makes life a little bit more difficult for you. Your other question is there a continuum? Are dyscalculics at one end of a continuum? My feeling is that they're qualitatively different from other arithmetic learners. That is, it's their ability to perceive the number of objects in a set efficiently that really marks them out. Now, of course, there might be individual differences. There might be a continuum in that, though nobody's really investigated it, so I don't know. But it's not on a continuum with the rest of arithmetical learning. Now, if you use a standardized test, like the Wyatt or something like that, then it's going to look as though there's a continuum, because these standardized tests are designed to have a normal distribution, and they pick up all the things that are relevant to learning arithmetic, including memory and to some extent language, to some extent other cognitive capacities. And so anything that makes you good or bad at arithmetic is going to be picked up by these standardized tests. But it's not going to enable you to distinguish between those who are bad because they're dyscalculic and those who are bad for other reasons. Like, for example, we know that children who get a lot of numerical experience in the home before they come to school start with a big advantage, and those who don't get much numerical experience in the home environment start with a disadvantage. So a standardized test is going to pick up, if you like, the home environment as well as everything else. So standardized tests are useful, but they don't tell you whether a child is dyscalculic or not. For that, you need a specialized test.
So those tests have been designed by neuroscientists.
By a particular neuroscientist.
and are you satisfied that they are discerning and identifying a particular profile as you've just described? Is there MRI evidence that matches that data, and how do you correlate the two?
Okay, there are two questions here. The first is, am I satisfied with the validity of the test? Well, all tests can be improved, and we are thinking about ways to improve it. But one thing it does associate with very strongly is response to intervention. So we've done one study where there was a well-known intervention designed for 5 and 6 year olds who were having trouble learning arithmetic in school. And we took kids who were in the bottom 10%, identified by teachers and by a standardized test. And we divided them into two on the basis of our specialized dyscalculia test. And then we looked to see how well they responded to intervention. And so the kids who weren't dyscalculic but were equally bad at the start responded to intervention quite well, whereas the dyscalculics didn't respond very well. And when we did a follow-up study 3 months later, the dyscalculics hadn't really improved very much at all. In fact, the other kids hadn't improved as much as they ought to have done. And I think that's because the intervention perhaps wasn't as well designed as it might be. So that's one answer to one question. The other question is, does the test relate to what we find in the brain? There's a bit of evidence for this, that in the pioneering classical study by Elizabeth Isaacs and her colleagues at the Institute of Child Health, they found indeed it did, that they had two groups of adolescents. One group was dyscalculic, and the other group was non-dyscalculic. And the dyscalculics were as good as the non-dyscalculics on all cognitive tests. It was just on their numerical abilities that they were bad. And what she and her colleagues found, was that there was reduced grey matter density in one particular bit of the parietal lobe. Since then, there have been other studies which show not only that there are differences in the structure of that area, but also that it activates in a different way. So one thing that is well known for a long time, from work by Stanislas Dehaene and his colleagues in Paris, is that if you've got a comparison between two numbers, say 3 and 5, or two numerosities, that is 3 things and 5 things, you have to say, for example, which is the bigger set or the bigger number, then the closer together those two numbers are, the more this particular area activates. So there's a kind of correlation between the numerical distance and activation in just that area, nowhere else. And it turns out, some work by Gavin Price and others, that dyscalculics don't show that difference in the activation. So it doesn't matter whether the numbers are similar or very different, it activates in the same way. So the brain doesn't seem to be picking up this numerical ability. And that's actually something that we found. Some work I did with Fulvia Castelli a long time ago is we found that, first of all, that you get this effect in normals, and it in that particular area. And it doesn't matter if you present all the objects together, say a block of 3 blue squares and 5 green squares, or if you present them one at a time, blue, 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 green, 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 blue, blue, blue. It's the same area. So this area in the brain is picking up, if you like, the abstract concept of number. There's also been some research, in my view, not completely decisive, that the connections between the relevant brain areas is different in dyscalculics. So, as I said, the critical area is the left parietal lobe, but there's a link to the left frontal lobe, and there's some evidence that this link is different in dyscalculics. But as I say, this needs to be replicated, maybe with different populations. I didn't think in that particular study that showed that the dyscalculics were really dyscalculic enough, and so it's hard to tell exactly what's going on there.
Are there any typical, more common, should we say, comorbidities that you're picking up? Because it sounds to me like you're emphasising this very distinctive low in a cognitive profile, as opposed to something that we're seeing more often at the moment, where there are several lows and they interact, and that can be very complex.
There's quite a lot of evidence that neurodevelopmental problems are comorbid. So you often find dyscalculia with dyslexia, sometimes with ADHD, sometimes with autistic spectrum disorder. And the problem is that these other conditions are much better known than dyscalculia. So you find a child who's dyslexic is also bad at numbers, and you say, well, it's the dyslexia that's causing this child to be bad at numbers. We've got quite a lot of evidence that this isn't the case. They are dyslexic and they're dyscalculic, and the reason why they are comorbid is not clear.
Mm.
So we've looked at the genetics of this, we don't know the genes that are involved, but if you look at large-scale twin studies, what you find is there's some kind of genetic effect that's specific to mathematics, and another genetic effect that's specific to reading and language. So our view is that it's bad luck, really bad luck, if you're dyslexic and dyscalculic, but the one doesn't cause the other.
Mm.
We've also been looking at a very large-scale study we carried out in Cuba, national study, with over 20,000 kids. And we looked at dyscalculia and dyslexia, and this is dyslexia in Spanish. And you can do the statistics in a different way from the way that I've normally done it. This is because the Cuban scientists are better statisticians mm-hmm. than me. And if you use a different kind of statistic, it might turn out to be the case that you don't get significant comorbidities. However, we haven't finished that analysis, and it's going to be controversial, I know. So I think that anybody who's a professional in this area, a teacher or a psychologist, should be aware of the fact, first of all, that you do get comorbidities, but that each condition needs to be treated separately. So you can treat the dyslexia, but it's not going to help the dyscalculia, or you can treat the dyscalculia, but it's not going to help the dyslexia.
What about prevalence? What's it telling us, the research, about how prevalent dyscalculia is?
Broadly speaking, it's about as prevalent as dyslexia. Depends if you use strict criteria. People have used different criteria to pick out the dyscalculics. They seem to converge on the same number, which suggests that dyscalculia is what we psychologists call construct validity. And it's somewhere between 4%, which is what we found in Cuba, and 7%, which is what they found in Israel. Using a slightly different methodology. So I would say about 5% is probably approximately right.
So, I mean, and that's we're very, very used to accommodating as teachers the idea that we have a high percentage of dyslexia in our schools, but we're not as familiar with dyscalculia. Why is that, and why is it now feel as though it's more controversial and slower to take hold in terms of our pedagogy in schools, would you say?
I think there are really two reasons for this. One is that there is not an organisation of angry parents who know about this and raise this issue with their politicians and with other relevant authorities. We've just asked a parliamentary question about dyscalculia. We haven't yet got a parliamentary answer. And my MP will no doubt communicate with me as soon as we get an answer. So we're trying to get government to be more aware of it. If you look on the government website, there's nothing about dyscalculia, except that for some reason or other, which I don't understand, it will disqualify you from driving a heavy goods vehicle. Don't ask me why this should be the case. I have no idea. Yeah. And how strictly it's enforced, again, I have no idea. So recognition is really key here.
Yeah.
And the question is, why isn't there recognition? Why aren't parents more concerned about it? Well, it's a kind of vicious circle. If they don't know about it, they're not going to get angry about it. If they're not going to get angry about it, then nothing's going to happen. So we're trying to kickstart the process of getting more recognition and therefore angrier parents, or at least parents who are angry for a specific reason. It might help their kids get the kind of help that they need. And the other reason, I think, is that I've been banging on about this for 15 years with no apparent effect. What people want to know is, what's the point of labelling a child as dyscalculic if there's nothing you can do about it? Well, I think there is something you can do about it. I think just like dyslexia needs specialised help, so dyscalculia needs specialised help. So it's no good getting these kids to recite their multiplication tables. It doesn't help. You've got to try and overcome their initial handicap, which is understanding the number of objects in a set, what we call the numerosity of a set. They're not very good at seeing this, so you have to help them see it. Then you have to help them link that concept of set size with the way in which we normally talk about or write about set sizes, namely with words like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and with the digits 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So any kind of intervention's got to start with sets. It's got to keep on with sets, and then move on to linking sets with counting words and with digits, and then the operations on sets with the arithmetical operations. Now, people are beginning to realise this. We, for example, have developed a digital game which does precisely what I've just said. We're currently testing it in various locations in London. We've done some work which is encouraging. Italy has done a larger scale study where kids have been playing this game at home rather than in school. We're doing a large scale trial in Singapore. We're doing a small scale trial in China, and we might do a trial in Cuba. But the problem with Cuba is that most schools are not on the internet. Mm. So this is where the game is and how we collect the data. Mm. But anyway, we've got quite a lot of data now, and it all looks encouraging. And if it really does work, then of course it'll be made available to everybody who wants to use it.
Okay. And just to go back on that, so you're actually saying that at the root of this, numerosity is really the key thing that we need to ensure is foundational in their development and learning. Are there other things, therefore, around numerosity that we ought to be doing as educators that we're not currently doing? I.e., is it just the interventions that we need to think about, like the game you've described? Or are there things within the curriculum for numeracy that would support that development of numerosity?
That's a very good question. My guide to these questions was my late colleague Dorian Yeo, and we wrote a book together called Dyscalculia Guidance. And one of the things that she was very clear about was that first year in school in England was really good for dyscalculics because they use a lot of concrete materials, manipulating concrete materials, so you could see the way in which sets combine or split apart, the way that a set has a particular number, numerosity, and so on. Then when you get to year two, all these very useful concrete materials are put away in the cupboard. which is fine for most kids, but it's not fine for dyscalculics. So what I would say is that dyscalculics are going to need concrete materials for longer than typically developing kids. They're probably not going to remember the results of using concrete materials as well as typically developing kids. So you may have to go over things more often with them than you would with typically developing kids. So it requires two things on the part of the teacher. One is a good memory for where the child got to yesterday, and patience that the child who seemed to remember it yesterday doesn't remember it today. I think those are things that one can do practically.
That's really helpful. I mean, that is something very substantial. It's also telling us something about learning that we know to be important for learners with any form of neurodevelopmental difficulty, which
That's
is
right.
to have those concrete examples and models rather than the abstract in the first instance. I'm interested, though, in the point that you made about repetition, about not just the teacher remembering but the child remembering until they're comfortable and can see the concept. Have you looked at working memory in relation to dyscalculia, and do you think there's a correlation there?
Working memory seems to be important in getting skillful at arithmetic, and this is true for typically developing kids and dyscalculics. Dyscalculics can have entirely normal working memory. So poor working memory doesn't seem to be a cause. It's not clear whether it's comorbid either. So it's easy enough to find kids with normal working memory but with dyscalculia. It's also easy to find kids who are not dyscalculic but poor working memory. We actually published a study earlier this year on kids on Groote Island. Groote Island is an island off the north coast of Australia where the kids speak a language called Anindilyakwa. Anindilyakwa does not have any counting words in it. This makes it similar to many other Australian languages. And we tested these kids who had no, if you like, cultural input for numbers, so they didn't have counting words, didn't have counting practices like body part counting. And the question was, did they have a normal sense of numerosity? Answer, yes, they did. But the other thing we wanted to know was, of course, there are going to be individual differences among these kids. What makes one kid better at arithmetic than another kid? Now, of course, you can't do, you know, you can't ask somebody, you know, what's 3 plus 5, because they don't know a word for 3, and they don't know a word for 5, and they don't know a word for plus. So we had to find another way of testing them. So we would have 3 objects, cover them up, add 5 objects under the cover, and they could see all this going on. Then what they had to do was recreate what was under the cover on their own tray. And so some kids were good at this, some kids not so good at it. And the question is, what distinguished the good kids from the bad kids? It turned out to be spatial working memory, which we tested individually. Not intelligence, but spatial working memory. Actually, one of the curious things here was that Aboriginal kids are meant to be not very good at maths. One of the reasons that's been suggested is that basically they don't have very high IQs. You know, they live in these remote places. So we used a standard test of IQ called Raven's Coloured Progressive Matrices, which is meant to be culture fair. It turned out that actually they were significantly better than the kids in Melbourne who grew up speaking English. Now, I don't want to overinterpret this, and in our published paper we didn't overinterpret it. One of the possibilities, which I think is likely, is that actually this particular test loads heavily on spatial abilities, because it's a kind of spatial test. You have matrices that you have to fill in. And it's been known for many years that Aboriginals, for reasons that I won't go into now, have got very good spatial cognition. And it may just be that because they've got very good spatial cognition, they're actually better at this test than kids who grew up in a kind of numeric culture that we grew up in. So I don't want to overinterpret that, but minimally, the reason why these kids were not good at maths, we'll see how they end up later on in life, it's not because they're not very smart, it's because, they haven't had the appropriate cultural input.
Fascinating. What an interesting lens on that. So I'm going to finish with one final question around this. You've talked about the importance of identification and therefore being able to say that someone is dyscalculic. But you've also talked about in great detail and with great sort of insight around the profiling of learners and their relative strengths and weaknesses. So I think you'll probably know what my question is. Mm. How important does it remain for you, therefore, to have the identified label of dyscalculia if, in a perfect world, which we're working toward, we as teachers are able to profile those learners and recognise the importance of numerosity for those who are demonstrating weaker skills in this area?
Well, of course, labelling is a controversial area. All the dyscalculics I've talked to are very glad to have been labelled because they have seen to be able to... They are seen to be unable to do what everybody else in their class could do. It's very public. Their failure is very public. And since your mathematical ability is often thought of as a kind of proxy for intelligence, they're regarded as stupid, just in the way that people who found it very difficult to learn to read 40 years ago were regarded just as stupid. And that people who... Parents who said, well, my child isn't stupid, my child is dyslexic. Dyslexia was meant to be a middle-class explanation for the stupidity of the children. Turns out, of course, that wasn't correct. And in fact, the first dyslexic that we came across was really, really lucky. She was regarded as educationally subnormal. That was the term that was used in those days. But... She was lucky because her mother was a paediatrician and knew that she wasn't educationally subnormal, but that she had this specific problem learning to read. This was before dyslexia was kind of widely understood. And so this child was taught to read in a different way and ended up reading atypically, but relatively competently. Anyway, I think the situation with dyscalculia is, in fact, rather similar, that... labelling is a way of telling the learner that the reason for the failure is not stupidity, but is something very specific, as in dyslexia. Secondly, the label tells the teacher that you need to use some specialised method to help this child, not what you give all the rest of the kids. So I think labelling is useful for dyscalculic learners.
That's really helpful. And I think also from what you've said, it takes us an even step further than that, that actually that label can be our start point, but actually then the specificity with which you focused on the numerosity might actually help us develop further pedagogies that actually support the dyscalculia better. Yeah. And actually, it's encouraging to me to see that label as the start point and then the pedagogy to be the next step based on the profile of that learner,
right?
Which I think can be very helpful. That, and also just to go back to, it's not just the numerosity, I think the other thing that I really will take away from this is about those foundational understandings and recognitions, and around the concrete practices that support those, which we, no matter the age or stage of the learner, we need to really return to when those foundations aren't clearly displayed. Would that be fair? Thank you so much, Brian. I found that really interesting.
Good.
Yeah, really enjoyed it too. Thank you very, very much indeed.